This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. On the evening of October 18th, 1968, viewers of the CBS television network were treated to an episode in the third season of Star Trek. The title of that episode was, Is There in Truth No Beauty? Is There in Truth No Beauty? The plot is not important for our conversation. I think the title is, though. It's a line from the English poet George Herbert, Is There in Truth No Beauty? For centuries, humanity has been fumbling toward truth, toward a reverence for truth, and seeking the beauty in truth. From the Enlightenment through the scientific revolution to the fictional logic of Mr. Spock, the search for truth is regarded as one of humanity's highest callings. But my next guest wants us to reconsider that impulse to make truth the be-all, end-all, and instead think about the value of falsehood. Shankar Vedantam is the author, along with Bill Messler, of the new book, Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. He's also well known to public radio listeners as the host of the program Hidden Brain, which explores the forces and phenomena that shape our thinking, often without our knowledge. Shankar Vedantam, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. I'm really delighted to be here.
And listeners, we want to invite you, as ever, to join our conversation. The number is 800-222-9455. If you have a question or a comment for Shankar Vedantam about what we're talking about today, about the book, about Hidden Brain, about anything, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. So the central set piece of your book is a story about a massive deception that was actually centered here in Illinois, in the town of Moline. But before we get to that, I want to run through some of the common sort of everyday delusions or deceptions that you outline at the beginning of the book. And I thought we could begin in 2015 at the White House Correspondents Association dinner. President Obama was joined by actor Keegan-Michael Key of the show Key and Peele to perform one of his recurring characters. The idea here is that Obama was so contained and controlled all the time, he needed an anger translator named Luther to tell people what he was really thinking.
In our fast-changing world, traditions like the White House Correspondents' Dinner are important.
I mean, really? What is this dinner? And why am I required to come to it? Jeb Bush, do you really want to do this?
Because despite our differences, we count on the press to shed light on the most important issues of the day.
And we can count on Fox News to terrify old white people with some nonsense. Sharia law is coming to Cleveland, run for the damn hills! Y'all is ridiculous!
All right, Shankar Vedantam, what is going on there?
Well, this was part of the hit television show Key and Peele. But the idea when Obama brought Keegan-Michael Key to the White House Correspondents' Dinner was in some ways to channel what was happening inside his own mind without actually having to say it. And so the idea of the Key and Peele skit was that Obama had an anger translator named Luther, who was sort of revealing what was actually happening in Obama's mind, even as he came across to the rest of us as cool and calm and collected. And the reason I mentioned this little incident in my book is because I think this happens to all of us on a daily basis, Brian. All of us find ourselves, if we are part of the human club, censoring ourselves or shaping what it is that we say in order to get along with other people. We do this with our loved ones. We certainly do this at work. If we simply said everything that was on our mind all the time to the people around us, very quickly we would find we have no friends, we have no partners, and we would likely be fired. And so in some ways, the deceptions that are involved in routine human communications are in some ways the first concentric circle, if you will, of what is actually a much larger picture, which is in our daily lives, it is the case that self-deception and deception can cause great harm, but it also turns out paradoxically that we're also deeply dependent on them, and the politenesses of daily life are one of the best ways to see this up close and personal.
Yeah, and I mean, when you stop to think about the number of deceptions we all probably many of us engage in on a daily basis, be it a work colleague, you know, says, how you doing? And you say, oh, fine. you know, or you say that at the lunch counter you might visit or something like that. I mean, that's one level. But I mean, if you stop and think about it, our lives are filled with these sort of deceptions. And you write about it. It actually took a while for scientists to come to understand this and come to grips with this.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's partly because, you know, when we think about ourselves, we don't even think of these as being deceptions. I think of myself as being an honest person. And if you ask me how often do I lie, I would tell you I don't lie. I'm an honest person during my day. But when psychologists have basically run experiments where they ask people to try and go 24 hours or 48 hours or a week without ever lying, and not just the lies where you say you're not having an affair when you're having an affair, not the big lies, but just sort of the routine everyday lies that we tell, it turns out that people are barely able to follow the experiment for a few hours before they realize that some amount of deception is sort of a necessary ticket for entry into the human club.
And it's actually valued in some ways, right? We talk about people who are emotionally intelligent as being mm-hmm. a valued attribute, particularly in the workplace. There are entire books on this subject written, you know, Harvard Business Review articles and that sort of thing. But there is a sort of core of deception involved in being emotionally intelligent, right?
There absolutely is. I mean, I've had managers, and I'm sure you've had managers, who basically simply tell you exactly what's on their mind. You know, no filter, no varnish. And these people don't come across to us as brave truth tellers. They usually come across as cold or cruel or rude. And on the other hand, all of us have also known people in the workplace who are very skilled managers. You know, even when they have something critical to say, they're able to say it in a way that sort of in some way softens the blow. They maybe tell you something that really went well about your recent report, or they tell you what you're doing great. And then they say, what sounds like a suggestion of how you can improve what you're doing. And we adore these people. We think that they're wonderful because we call them emotionally intelligent, that they're so attuned to how we're feeling. But of course, what this means to say we're attuned to how someone else is feeling is that we're very skilled at modifying what we're saying in order to allow them to be able to hear us better. And you can argue, of course, that this is deception and this is a bad thing. But you can also argue this is what successful managers and coaches and parents do, that they're able to couch what it is they have to say in a language that allows them to be heard better so that people don't get upset or they don't feel disrespected. They feel like they're valued. And in fact, they can listen to the feedback being given to them.
Yeah, my wife works with medical residents and calls this form of feedback a praise sandwich, or where you sort of wrap the criticism in two slices of praise.
I love the idea of the praise sandwich. That's beautiful.
So I want to think, before we get into the Moline story, about the one other aspect of this as it relates to politicians, and we can come back to this a little more on this later, but something that you... You know, we hear a lot of commentators saying that, for example, when Republicans parrot former President Trump's big lie that the election was not free and fair, that, you know, we didn't all see a bunch of people waving Trump flags storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. They say politicians must know better. But you write that by telling us what we want to hear, politicians come to think that they believe those things all along. Mm-hmm. How is it that simply repeating falsehoods, indulging in some of these delusions, can come to affect the way we perceive reality?
Yeah, this is part of a larger phenomenon, really, Brian, which is it's called audience tuning. So as people talk to one another, as you and I talk to each other, for example, I'm paying very close attention to what you're saying, how you're putting things, and I'm trying to quickly read what's happening in your mind. What kind of things does Brian want to hear? What would make me a more interesting conversationalist as I talk with Brian? And all of us do this routinely on a regular basis as we talk to other people. We try and imagine what they want to hear. And of course, when this happens, one of the things that the consequences is that we start to modify what we say so that it suits the other person a little more. So in other words, if you're communicating bad news to someone, you're likely to couch it in a way that perhaps the person can hear a little bit better. Or if you know that somebody is a diehard music fan or a rock music fan, and you really hate rock music because you're really a classical music guy, you're not going to go up to that person and say that rock music is terrible. You know, you might sort of say, oh, you know, there are some bands that I like. In other words, you couch and you shade the truth in order to seem more palatable to the people you're talking with. Politicians, of course, do this on steroids. They're talking to large numbers of people. And of course, part of being a politician is to reflect back to people what their beliefs already are. And research studies have found that when we do this, as we talk to people, even when we're dissembling, even when we are being deceptive, one of the things that happens is that our minds start to believe what it is that we're actually telling other people. So in other words, we might start out saying, I am going to present myself to Brian in a way that Brian will think that I'm a nice guy and will like me. But as I start to present myself to Brian in this way, I start to believe that the version of me that I'm presenting to you is in fact the real version. So it's not to say that politicians never lie. I'm sure politicians lie with some frequency. But it is to say that I think when politicians sometimes say outlandish things and we say, surely they must know better, it's possible that they might not. That in some ways, as they come up with deceptions or, you know, perversions of the truth, the more often they say these things, the more often they themselves come to believe that the things that they're saying are true.
And there's a deep evolutionary advantage there, right? It's thought that this might be the root of self-deception in human beings.
Yeah, so people have argued for a long time why you would, you know, why would you have self-deception? Why would you build a brain that is capable of deceiving itself? If you think of the brain as being an organ that it's designed to focus and pay attention to reality, to process reality accurately, why would you build self-deception into the brain? And there are lots of different theories about why this might be. One of the theories is that by deceiving ourselves, we can actually deceive others better. In other words, if I can convince myself that I'm a good person, I'm more likely to be able to convince you that I'm a good person. But there's also a deeper reason, which is I think that we misunderstand what the brain is actually designed to do. The brain is fundamentally not in the truth business. The brain is in the business of survival, adaptation, and reproduction. These are the things that the brain cares about. The brain is an organ handed down to us through millions of years of evolution. We come from a long line of ancestors who all were able to adapt and survive and reproduce. And so our brains are deeply calibrated to paying attention to what will get us to those goals. Now, if paying attention to reality and processing reality accurately gets us to those goals, the brain is very happy to process reality accurately. But it turns out that if self-deception gets us to those goals, the brain is just as willing to reach for self-deceptions if they can actually get to those longer-term goals.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Shankar Vedantham. He's the host of the Hidden Brain podcast and public radio show, and the co-author of Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. 800-222-9455 is our number if you want to join our conversation. 800-222-9455. So you spend a large part of the book detailing a sprawling deception centered in Illinois. This was the case of men all over the country who were corresponding with what they thought were lonely, caring women. Many cases, they developed deep attachments, but over time they sent money and gifts, except it turns out it was all a direct mail operation based in Moline. The men had been deceived. Before we get into the details, how did you first come to hear about this story?
I read about the story in a very obscure scientific paper. I was reading a paper in one of the peer-reviewed journals that I read regularly, and it was talking about this unusual case that had unfolded in the 70s and 80s, and I had never heard of this story, but it prompted me to go and look up information on it. At the heart of the story was a balding middle-aged man in Illinois. His name was Donald Lowry. And in the late 60s, early 70s, he hit upon this unusual idea. He was a writer, and he hit upon this unusual idea that he could invent characters, young women whom he called angels, and then write love letters in their voices to thousands of lonely men across the United States. And over time, he was surprised to find that some of the men he wrote to actually started writing back to him, or at least writing back to the young women they thought they were corresponding with. And Don Lowry realized there was a business to be made here. And he started essentially selling love letters. I mean, the whole business, that, which was called the Church of Love, was essentially a scheme where members were asked to contribute small amounts of money in exchange for a continuing stream of love letters from these angels. In its heyday, the Church of Love boasted as many as 30,000 men across the United States. And Donald Lowry himself collected millions of dollars from these men, which in 1980s money is a lot of money, would be a lot of money today.
If this story sounds familiar to listeners, they might have heard it covered. You did a version of this for This American Life, and that was later replayed on Hidden Brain. I wonder, what was your attitude going into this story? What did you expect to make of, particularly the men who were the marks, right, who participated in this?
Yeah. So, I mean, my initial reaction when I heard the story was disbelief. I was like, who would fall for a scam like this? Who would receive a love letter and believe that it had actually been written to him and actually write back? And, you know, many of the men in the Church of Love formed relationships with the women. They believed that they had actually found their soulmates. Some of them signed mystic marriage pledges, pledging themselves forever to the person whom they thought was writing to them. And my first reaction was, this is absurd. Who would actually do such foolish things? The thing that really amazed me about the story, Brian, and the reason that I realized that it had deep psychological roots, is when Donald Lowry was finally arrested and brought to trial on charges of mail fraud, several members of his Church of Love, several members who had been essentially the marks, showed up at the trial to defend him. And I found this astonishing. Once the con has been revealed, why would the marks show up to defend the con man? And in many ways, it was a starting point for this larger discussion about the role that self-deception plays in our lives, especially when it comes to our intimate relationships and the emotion of love.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break here. We're speaking with Shankar Vedantham, author of Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. He's also host of the Hidden Brain podcast. If you want to join our conversation, the number to call is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. When we come back, we're going to hear more about this Church of Love, which was essentially a direct mail fraud centered in Moline, Illinois, as we've been hearing. And remarkably, when the fraudster, Donald Lowry, was brought to justice at trial in Peoria, some of his marks showed up to defend him. We're going to hear more about that coming up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Shankar Vedantham, co-author of Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. He's also host of Hidden Brain, a podcast and public radio program that airs on a number of our partner stations. And before the break, we were talking about organization called the Church of Love. It was based in Moline, Illinois. It was essentially a direct mail operation that corresponded with men all over the country. They thought they were developing close personal relationships with individual women. Turns out, as I said, it was a direct mail operation that collected money from these people. Ultimately, the person who was behind it was prosecuted for, I believe it was postal fraud. And Shankar, when you were reporting this story, you met a man named Joseph Enriquez. How did he inform your view of what you were expecting from these people who were the supposed victims of this fraud?
Yeah, Joseph Enriquez was a man who lived in Texas at the time, and he was one of the members of the Church of Love who testified on Don Lowry's side for the defense during the trial. And I got to know him a little bit. I've interviewed him multiple times. And his story in some ways became very revealing to me because I started to understand, not from the outside in, but from the inside out, how many members felt about the letters that they were receiving. So like many of the other members, Joseph Enriquez began receiving the love letters from Donald Lowry at a low point in his life. Things were not going well for him. He had suffered numerous personal setbacks. His life was in disarray. And the letters, when they started arriving, in some ways served as a kind of lifeline. Donald Lowry realized very early, he in some ways had a very astute understanding of human psychology, that even though, you know, superficially it might seem that sex sells and, you know, sultry photographs might be what people sign up for, what really keeps people coming back is the sense that someone is in their corner, someone actually is looking out for them, someone is on their side. And if you read some of the love letters that Don Lowry sent to his members, including Joseph Enriquez, I started to see myself how powerful this could be. If someone is writing letters to you on a daily basis, telling you that you're a good person, that you're a misunderstood person, that you have so much to look forward to, that you're a kind person, and that you have so much to offer to the world, and you know, you should look up and you should have hope. Especially, I think, if you are at a very bad place in your life, a message like that carries enormous power. It has enormous, enormous hope. And by the time Donald Lowry was brought to trial, Joseph Enriquez had come to think that the woman who was writing to him was not just someone who he was sexually attracted to, but someone whom he really felt was a soulmate, somebody who truly understood him, someone who saw him as nobody else could see him, and someone who was truly on his side. And in some ways, you can see how the same phenomenon affects many, many people in many, many relationships that are not fictitious relationships like the one that Joseph Enriquez had. Many people in real relationships delude themselves about what their partners are offering or what their partners think of them, because the alternative to sort of understand that what they see is not real is too painful. In the movie The Truman Show, which is a story about a man who's actually part of a reality show, except that everybody else in the movie are actually actors. He's the only one who doesn't realize he's part of a reality show. You know, so his wife is an actor, his children are actors, his friends are actors, his coworkers are actors. The reason that it's really hard for him to pierce this deception is that the Truman, the character in the movie, has to essentially discard all the personal relationships in his life. He has to see that his wife is not really his wife, his best friend is not really his best friend. He has to throw these relationships overboard in order to be able to see the truth. That is remarkably difficult to do. In all of our lives, our personal relationships are what hold us together. For Joseph Enriquez, the letters had become that anchor in his life, which is when they, you know, so when the postal inspector brought Donald Lowry to trial and charged him with mail fraud, for Joseph Enriquez, it felt catastrophic because it felt this life support, this beacon in his life was being taken away.
And you think it might have mattered to him that it wasn't real, but that, I mean, that was not the case. Why do you think it was that even after the deception had been unmasked and it was clear that Pamela, I believe, was the woman he was corresponding with, you know, had, you know, correspondences with hundreds of people and probably wasn't even the person writing the letters herself, and they were shown to be form letters, and yet he stuck with it?
Yeah. So in Joseph Enriquez's case, it perhaps was especially complicated because the love letters he was receiving were from a woman whose name was Pamela. But it turned out that Pamela was also the name of a woman who actually worked as Donna Lowry's assistant in the Church of Love, and actually had played a role in actually conducting the scheme. And so when Donna Lowry was brought to trial, this woman, Pamela, was also brought to trial with him. And so part of what Joseph was trying to do when he came to, you know, speak on behalf of the defense was he was trying to defend this woman whom he believed that he was in love with and that who was in love with him. And yes, he had discovered at this point that there were multiple men who had the same relationship with Pamela, multiple men who thought that they were, who had found their soulmate in Pamela. And he was disappointed when this happened, but it did not shake his commitment. You know, psychologists sometimes talk about the phenomenon of cognitive dissonance. It's the idea that when we are deeply invested in something being true, you know, we will go to great lengths to prevent ourselves from seeing anything that could disprove what we want to believe. We see this all the time in politics. We see all this time, you know, when sports fans are looking at controversial plays, cognitive dissonance plays a very powerful role. In Joseph's case, unfortunately, it played a role as he became ensnared in this con.
And even years later, decades later, when you were interviewing him, you said he still had photographs of the woman that he thought he was corresponding with.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the amazing thing, which is that years later, he remembers his relationship with Pamela as being one of the high points of his life, as one of the most important and valuable things in his life. And again, you know, it's easy from the outside in to basically question whether that makes sense. But when you step back and look at the bigger picture, I would argue that Joseph might be on the extreme end of a spectrum on which all of us find ourselves. All of us tell ourselves stories about the relationships that we're in. All of us tell ourselves stories about the kind of communities that we find ourselves in. And these stories play a very important role in sustaining us. I explore at some length in my book the value of useful delusions when it comes to our personal relationships. It turns out that people who believe they are with partners who are more beautiful than they are, more intelligent than they are, more empathetic and kinder than they really are, people who believe better things about their partner than their partners really are, end up in happier relationships. Now, it's sort of self-evident at one level. If you think that you're actually with someone who is amazing, it's not surprising that you would say, I really should stay with this person. But this is what love does. And there's a reason, you know, we've known for decades, for eons, that when people say love is blind, this is what they mean, which is that the emotion of love has this powerful effect of clouding our judgment. But the paradox is that as a result of clouding our judgment, being deeply in love can also make us happy. So the trade-off is not let's all let the scales drop from our eyes, because it turns out when we do this, we actually end up in relationships that are less happy than they could be otherwise.
We're talking with Shankar Vedantam, author of Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. So what are the broader implications of the self-deceiving brain, especially for those of us who think of ourselves as rationalists?
Yeah, let me give you the simplest example. And perhaps this might actually be the reason why, you know, self-deception sort of evolved in the brain. Think about the relationship that we have with our children. You know, when my daughter was born, Brian, you know, I thought not only that she was the most special child in the world, I thought she was the most special child in the history of the world. All right? I thought that she was just the most amazing thing that had ever happened to anyone ever. Now, it turns out that millions of parents believe exactly the same thing about their children. And of course, when you step back and look at it, you have to say it cannot possibly be the case that millions of parents are simultaneously correct, that their child is the most special child in the history of the universe. It's logically nonsense. But the reason that we believe this, the reason that parents believe this, is it turns out parenting is remarkably hard. It's time consuming, it's difficult, it's frustrating, it's expensive. But the delusional love that parents have for their children buffers them in some ways against the body blows that parenting delivers. And so you can see very quickly from an evolutionary perspective, does it make sense for evolution to imbue us with a mad love for our offspring? Absolutely. The reason you and I are on the planet today is because our ancestors, you know, forsook their sanity and perhaps their lives in order to allow us to basically come into existence, to allow our ancestors to be born. And so you can see how very quickly something that on the surface encourages mistruth or deception can turn out to be functional. So the larger picture of the book is not to say that deception is always good. I go to great lengths in the book to explain how self-deception and deception can produce terrible harms. But it is to say that just because deception and self-deception can produce great harms does not mean that they can also not produce great good. And I think in some ways that's the part of the picture that we have missed, which is in as much as that we're right to identify all the problems with self-deception and deception, we in some ways have overlooked all the ways we benefit from self-deception and deception in our own lives.
And you also say that if we, those of us who are rationalists, if we want to deal with everything from conspiracy theories about politics and pandemics to the fight ahead on climate change, we need to reckon yes. with this self-deception and the role that plays.
That's right. I mean, at the heart of the book is an argument about why it is these self-deceptions arise. And rather than see these as examples of idiocy or lunacy, the book is trying to make the case that the delusions that I'm talking about, I'm not talking about delusions, you know, involving serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia, but the everyday delusions that I'm talking about in the book arise because they serve a certain psychological purpose. So in other words, the delusions that I have when I tell you something and come to believe it myself, it serves a psychological purpose because what I'm trying to do, Brian, is I'm trying to be friends with you. I'm trying to get close to you. That's the reason why I tell you what I think you want to hear and why I start to believe it myself. So when it comes to combating delusions in our lives, one of the things that I think many people who have a rationalistic bent like I do, the way we often approach this is we try and disabuse people of their delusions by arguing with them or by presenting them with evidence. And of course, this is the way the rational approach to combating misstatements and untruth, but it doesn't take into account that the delusion, in fact, might be performing some kind of psychological function. And removing this delusion means that you're removing some kind of psychological crutch. One of the deep insights, I think, of the book is to basically say, if you want to disabuse people of their delusions, you might actually have to start from a position of empathy, not from a position of contempt or judgment, but from a position of empathy and ask, what is this delusion accomplishing in this person's life? What is it that makes this person want to believe in it? What would this person have to give up if they were to give up this delusion? And then you ask yourself, is there an other way to supply the psychological need? Can this person's psychological needs be met in some other way? And my belief is that if you do that, people are much more willing now to give up beliefs that are not tied to their own psychological well-being. The reason many delusions are very hard to dislodge is not because there isn't ample evidence against them, but because we're underestimating the psychological benefits that those delusions deliver in people's lives.
So don't print off the latest guidance from the CDC or an article from JAMA or something like that about vaccinations. Try and find out why is somebody holding off on that, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, ask yourself how effective that's been. I mean, when was the last time you presented someone with a peer-reviewed study from JAMA and they sort of said, oh, wow, that's true. I'm going to totally change my mind about some deeply held view. I mean, when was the last time that ever happened to you? When was the last time someone presented you with a study and you changed your mind on something that you thought was vitally important? In many ways, I think the evidence is sort of staring us in the face that a more compassionate, kinder approach to thinking about these delusions might actually be more effective. And in some ways, this reflects the way I came to think of the Church of Love. You know, I started out thinking of the members of the Church of Love as being poor, deluded fools. I had contempt for them. By the time I finished my reporting, I think I came away with a great deal of empathy and compassion. I certainly don't think I would have done what they did, but I don't feel like what they did was completely bizarre.
Shankar Vedantham is the author of Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. He's also the host of the Hidden Brain podcast and public radio show. Check your local listings or just subscribe in your favorite podcast app. Shankar Vedantham, thank you so much for being with us and talking about your work today on the 21st.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Before we go, I do want to urge you to go subscribe to our podcast. You can find a link to that on our website, 21stshow.org. We're also on Apple Podcasts and NPR One, Spotify, Overcast, anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for The 21st. That's The 21st. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.